The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or KUCI Talk.
Good morning and welcome to this December 30th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live. Actually, this week we are not live. We are pre-recording from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org, and we are always available via podcast. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do every Wednesday morning, which is talk with authors not only about their books, but about their writing process, creativity, craft, all the things that separate those of us who write from those of us who publish. Today, it's all about young adult fiction. It is my pleasure to welcome YA rock star Marie Lu. And in the second half, I'm talking with Ellen Hopkins about her novel Traffic. So stay with us for that. But first, Marie. Marie is the author of the New York Times bestselling Legend series and The Young Elites. She graduated from USC and jumped into the video gaming industry, working for Disney Interactive Studios as a flash artist. Now a full-time writer, she spends her spare time reading, drawing, playing Assassin's Creed, and getting stuck in traffic. The Rose Society is the second book in the Young Elite series, hopefully not the last. It's published by Putnam, and it's what we're going to chat about, that and more this morning. Marie, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on the show.
So I have a 14-year-old daughter who said, I've been doing the show for almost 9 years, and she said, if Marie Lu ever comes on your show, that's it. You know, you're done. You win. And so she's never taken notice of the show until now, and she's not forgiving me for not letting her skip school to be here today.
No. That's very sweet.
So before we delve into the book, take us through this transition from video gaming to writing and what inspired that that jump, and what of the old life helps you in your writer's life?
Yeah, what's funny is I was kind of involved in doing both from a pretty young age. You know, when I first came over to the States, I was maybe 5 or 6 or so. And, you know, from that time onward, I've always been writing and drawing and playing video games on the side. That was just like such a part of my childhood that, you know, I kind of see all of them as seamlessly molded together in my head. So I've been writing with the goal of getting published since I was in high school. That was kind of when I started. And at the same time, you know, I was also doing a lot of drawing on the side. And after college, as I was still trying to get published, I ran across this kiosk on campus that had a bulletin from Disney Interactive Studios, and they were looking for art interns to join them at the studio, and I applied for that. And I got in and just sort of serendipitously, you know, fell into the video game industry for a while. So I've always been writing on the side, you know, before that and then during working in the gaming industry as well. So the two were always like side by side. And really, you know, I really loved working in the game industry, and the main reason why I stepped away from it was, you know, because as a full-time writer, there's a lot of travel involved. So I realized that, you know, I had to pick something, and if I have to choose between, you know, the gaming industry and writing, I would always choose writing. So that was why I stepped away from video games and decided to become a full-time writer. But my husband still works in games, so I'm still, you know, I still keep in touch with a lot of my friends who I used to work with, and so it's nice to still hear about the industry from them.
Yeah, and I mean, the books themselves feel really like video game landscapes. I mean, they're incredibly visual, they're incredibly immersive, and, you know, kind of these alternate universes with their own rules. And so I was wondering if that time kind of gave you a visual sense in your writing, if it kind of informs the way you build your worlds in the book.
Yeah, I think it did. I've noticed, and this is something that I think I do kind of unconsciously, but I've noticed that when I write stories, I put in game-like elements without realizing it. Like in Legend, the first book, there's these street duels that happen called Skiz Duels, and it's where my two main characters first meet. And I was totally inspired by Street Fighter. I didn't even think about it until I read back over. I was like, oh, of course, you know, I was picturing in my head like a game screen with these two people, you know, fight and with like life bars over them and stuff. So there's like these little bits of video games that creep in. And when I'm writing, I tend to visualize environments in this like 3D sort of map that I could rotate in my head. So it's, and I'm absolutely sure that that's because of playing video games and then seeing behind the scenes how games are made. So yeah, it's kind of become a part of my writing process.
You could actually make these books into video games. You should put your husband on that task, right?
Yeah, I would love to. You know, someday if we ever get lucky enough to do that.
My kid would be an avid player, I can tell you that. So introduce us to the Elite series. Kind of talk about the scopes of the books thus far and your inspiration for the series, what you started thinking about when you embarked on it, and, you know, kind of take us into this world a little bit.
Yeah. The Young Elites first started back when the second book in the Legend trilogy was coming out. So I was kind of itching for something else to work on. I was a little bit restless, so I started working on this story. And early on, it was very different from what the final version turned out to be. It was told from the point of view of a hero, which it's not now. It's told from the point of view of a villain in the final version. And when I first started writing it, it was just a story about kids with superpowers in a fantasy land. And I wrote about 100 pages of that, and I gave it to my agent. And my agent, who is a lovely person, you know, very kind, has always been amazing to me, but who does not sugarcoat anything if she doesn't like it. So she called me back after reading it, and she said, literally on the phone, you know, when you sent this to me, did you think that it was good? And yeah, and I was like, ow, Kristen. And so I asked her, you know, I was like, is there anything that you liked about this story, or should I, you know, just stop being a writer altogether? And Kristen said, well, I like your supervillain in this story. There's this girl named Adelina who was very, like, conniving and evil and manipulative, and she's like, she was really fun, you know. I liked her character a lot. And I was like, oh, you know, she was really fun for me to write, and I hope that if you give me a second chance at writing this story, I would love to keep her in the story. And Kristen just kind of, like, half-jokingly, you know, said, you know, well, maybe you can make her the main character. And that was what got the wheel turning in my head when she said that. And I thought, oh, maybe the problem with the story is that I don't want to tell it from the hero's point of view. Maybe it's a story meant for the villain's point of view. So I rewrote the story, and The Young Elites is now about this girl named Adelina, who is essentially the teen girl version of Darth Vader. She starts off the story as a relatively good person and then falls to the dark side. And the series chronicles how that happens to her and why she decides to become a villain. And it's told from her point of view, from her first-person point of view. And, you know, she has superpowers, and they're very, very dark powers, and she doesn't necessarily use them for good. So that's the basic arc of the story and how it came to be. And it'll be a trilogy as well.
Yeah. You know, the thing that really strikes me about how well this connects with teens is that they probably feel uniquely betrayed themselves, you know, even by their own bodies, but, you know, certainly by their parents and by their friends. And so the emotions are so relatable. And in the book, they're obviously so operatic, as teen emotions are, right? So you've tapped into something deep here with them.
Yeah, I hope it's something that that teens can relate to, and hopefully that other readers can relate to as well. It's just, I just remember drawing. It's hard to write from her point of view because she thinks some really horrible things sometimes. Yeah. So I have to force myself to believe everything. But, you know, just trying to draw in those moments of just extreme emotion, just like what you mentioned. Like, I'm thinking back to when I was a teenager and everything was new. You know, every experience was like the first time that ever happened, and everything was exaggerated. You know, my life was just full of extreme emotions. And even now, if I'm, like, I live in LA, so, you know, we mentioned traffic earlier, so, you know, that feeling when I'm stuck in traffic and just everything's going wrong and this person cuts you off in traffic, and I'm just like, I just want to see this, like, foot come down from the sky and just step on your car. You know, like, I'm like, I don't even care if you have a family, I'm sure you're a lovely person, but, like, in the heat of the moment, you know, that flash of anger, I feel like everybody can kind of relate to that. And I was just thinking, you know, what if I had powers, that would be horrible because I would probably act in the moment. And then afterwards, I was like, oh, my God, I totally regret what I just did. So just trying to draw on that was a bit of a learning experience for me.
Yeah. So talk about mining her character, getting all that, you know, anger and teenage angst and, you know, the, like I say, the operatic you know, fury, mm-hmm. and then continuing to keep her sympathetic and, you know, so readers, you know, readers are staying on board with her and kind of creating mm-hmm. a full body. No, nobody's purely evil. And so, right. you know, trying to create a full body character. Talk a little bit about bringing her fully fleshed to life so that the readers are on board with her.
Yeah, it was a really, really fine line to walk. And probably not something that I was even aware of how difficult that would be when I first started writing her. I wanted to explore the idea that, like you said, you know, no one is all evil. And the thing is, depending on whose point of view you're seeing the world from, everyone is the hero of their own story. You know, if Star Wars had been told from Anakin's point of view, he probably would have thought of himself as the hero. If the story is changed around from Magneto's point of view or, you know, Maleficent's point of view, like the roles of good and evil tend to be switched. So I always thought that was interesting and I wanted to play with that. But it was very challenging to make sure that readers can actually follow this character through without throwing them across the room and going, you're just crazy out of your mind. So I had to remember to give her some reason to believe what she does. You know, she has a very dark childhood, very traumatic, and it absolutely informs the person that she becomes. Her powers are very dark, and she's also surrounded by a couple of people who are good in her life, and that kind of helped her hang on to her sanity, and that helps to cut a little bit of her her darkness.
Right.
You know, she's still, you know, she has very angry thoughts, but she has a sister that she loves, and that she has a very, very complicated relationship with, like a love-hate relationship with. You know, she meets people that she wants to be friends with. And throughout the story, she kind of has this overarching longing to find a place where she belongs. You know, she goes through life wishing for people to accept her for who she is. And then when things go wrong, you know, they turn their backs on her. And that happens enough times to her that eventually she becomes bitter to the world. So so it was very, very hard to walk that line and make sure that she was, to show that these things are happening to her and we can sympathize with that, but at the same time showing that she reacts to them in the wrong way. So I think, at least for me, when I'm writing her, there would be moments where I'm thinking like, oh, girl, don't do that. Like, that's not the right thing to do, even though at the same time, I'm the horrible creator doing this to her in the first place. But even then, yeah, I'm wishing for her to, you know, get off of that path and go on to the right one, because I know what happened to her in the past. And I want to see her overcome that, even though I know as a creator that she's not going to.
Do you feel like she's driving the boat, or do you feel like you're the author behind her? I hear some writers talk about, mm-hmm. especially when you're writing in first person, this character just kind of takes on a life of their own and you're almost just transcribing. They're telling you what they're going to do rather than you forcing them into it. Did you have that sense?
Yeah, I did. I did. That happens to me with certain characters a lot more than others, and she was one of them. And she was a character that fought me every step of the way. Like, this series was so much harder to write because of her personality than the Legend series. In the Legend series, you know, I had two protagonists, and they... Even though they, you know, Legend is a dystopia, they live in a very dark world. Day and June were good people at heart. So they had very, like, they knew what was right and wrong. They had their heads on straight. You know, they came from good families. So it was never uncomfortable for me to be in their headspace. So I never really felt that pressure of them fighting against what I wanted them to do. But Adelina absolutely fought me every step of the way. There would be times where I wanted to write her into a scene in a certain way, and she just wouldn't have it. And I would have writer's block for weeks. And have to go back and redo her story and redo it. And then sometimes she would say something that I would make me, you know, kind of back away from my computer, like, whoa, did that just come out of my head? Right. Like, well, why would I ever think that? But it was something that she would have thought. So it was this weird combination of having created her, so knowing that she is this kind of person, and then just constantly being surprised by her thoughts as I went along.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Was she always going to be a first-person point-of-view character?
No, she's... Well, in the very, very early version, she was still the villain, but, you know, from like she was a third person side character from the that was being seen from the point of view of this, you know, main character that no longer exists.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so she was more like a traditionally viewed villain.
Gotcha.
Very like muhaha person that was on his side. And then, you know, when I step into her head, everything just sort of flipped to be the other way around.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. My guest this morning is Marie Lu. The book is The Rose Society. It's the second in the Young Elite series, and you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Let's talk a little bit about writing the second books in series, because second books always feel uniquely difficult. I know a lot of novelists mm-hmm. have trouble with the seconds. Is that true in a series? And, you know, kind of what challenges are presented by seconds?
Yeah, I have a lot of trouble writing second books in series. And I don't know why I forgot the second time around how hard it was the first time around. Because with the Legend series, Prodigy was so much harder for me to write than Legend, because that was the first book that I ever had to write with a contract. You know, it was the first, Legend was my first book that I ever published, so nobody knew that I was writing Legend. And I had no expectations to meet except my own. And so I was writing this little bubble. And then when I signed for the deal, it was a 3-book deal. So Prodigy was already under contract, and it was the first time I had to go, oh my God, there's people, I felt like I was in a little glass box now, and people could see me, you know, look over my shoulder and see what I'm typing. And I had like a deadline in the contract, and I remember having all kinds of panic attacks throughout that year, just going, oh my God, if I don't turn this in, if they don't like it, what's going to happen? I'm going to go to jail. I mean, I'm not going to go to jail, but that's what it felt like, you know? So it was really, really, I went through so many revisions on Prodigy. Legend took just 2 revisions, and Prodigy must have gone through at least 12 or 13 different rounds of revisions. So it was very, very challenging. And then in the Young Elites, with the Rose Society was by far the hardest book I've ever written, had to write in my life. And I don't know why, when I started it, I thought, oh, you know, I guess it's not that I have kids, but it's like childbirth, you know, it's horrible and painful when you do it. And then afterwards, oh, that wasn't so bad in hindsight. And I feel like I had that sort of mentality with it, where I looked back and was like, oh, Prodigy wasn't that hard to do. I can do this. And I started it and I was like, oh, this is why I had a hard time with Prodigy.
Right.
Yeah. And I think the challenge of that second book is everything's been set up now. All that setup that was done, you know, in the first book, introducing the characters, introducing the world, especially in a fantasy novel, which takes up so much of that first book, isn't really done in the second one. And suddenly I have all this stuff that's made, and I have to go, okay, now what? And especially since this book isn't the end of the series, so how do I find an ending in that that's not, you know, just a bridge, but that feels like an actual ending, but still leave room for the third and final book in the series. So that, coupled with the thing with the Rose Society, that the main character is bad. So this is the book where she really goes to the dark side. Like in the first book, you know, she starts off as kind of a relatively good person being handed a bad deck of cards in life, and ends that first book having had everyone who cares about her in life turn their backs on her. And so the end of the first book is really the beginning of her journey into darkness. And so the second book is incredibly dark, and it chronicles, you know, her lashing out against everyone who has wronged her in the first book. So that darkness in her head, coupled with the idea, all the challenges that come with the second book, made it incredibly hard for me to write The Rose Society. And so I'm really glad that the book is out now, and I would not want to go through that again just because it was so traumatically difficult.
Yeah, it does strike me as incredibly uniquely difficult to build and maintain suspense while not answering the questions. You know, you have to mm-hmm. to ask as many questions as you're going to answer in order to leave space for the third book. And you're right, you don't have all of the setup that the first book did. So that, mm-hmm. it's writing in a series. Do you think you'll always write trilogies? Is that sort of how your mind works?
Yeah, I think I might end up writing series all the time. I keep working towards writing a standalone, but I'm not sure if I have the mindset for that, just because as a kid growing up, I read almost exclusively fantasy and science fiction, and those tend to come in series. So I think because of that, my head is kind of trained to think in series. I just signed something for a new project that I'm working on, and it's probably going to be a duology, but like, it was something that I was trying to make into a standalone. And I was like, I can't do it. it's not going to fit in this. So I keep trying to get to that point, but it may take me a few more tries to actually get there.
Your brain is a big, vast landscape of stuff that can't be, I like that can't be contained. That's great. So sort of walk us through kind of what your physical, either brain space or office space looks like when you're creating. I mean, you're creating an entire universe with its own rules, some of its own language. You have a broad cast of characters, each with their own powers. So tell me sort of, you know, from a plot structure, character standpoint, how you keep all of this straight, how you keep the note card straight, the character arc straight. You know, what does your office look like?
My office is a little bit weird. It used to be a spare bedroom, and then when my husband and I first moved in, there was like a pipe that broke in our ceiling, just flooded the room. So it started off with just us having to redo the entire room. And so we figured, like, well, you know, if the insurance is paying for part of the damage anyway, we might as well do some renovations on it. So I added in like there was a closet that was that had been ruined by the water, so we changed that into a book nook instead. So now it's like a little sitting area where you can sit, and there's like all these shelves built into the former closet, and so that's like my little inspiration creative space. And then the wallpaper is actually this like black black and gray shiny wallpaper paired with like a white floor and white ceiling and light floor. So it's a little bit of a quirky room. I have like a plastic deer head hanging over my my computer that I call my Patronus, you know, from Harry Potter. And so it's a little bit quirky. It's a little bit artsy fartsy. So it kind of helps me get into the headspace for writing.
Do you map things? Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, do you map things out on the walls so that you can kind of visually see, you know, where the where the arc is going, or is everything kept in your computer?
Most of my notes are kept in the computer. I do have a notebook that I carry around with me all the time now that I will write down random thoughts that occur to me about the story. So I'm very disorganized that way. I have notes just all over the place. I have like notes on my phone, and I have notes in my little notebook, and I have like a notepad file on my computer where I'll jot down like random ideas. I have this like my you know, my actual schedule of what I'm supposed to do every day, and that poor file has just transformed over the year into like 95% just random notes that come to me and then like and like two columns of like, this is what you're supposed to do today. So I just kind of jot down stuff all over the place. I'm a bit of a pantser writer, so I just kind of make up stuff for the arc as I'm writing. So my first drafts are incredibly rough and don't make any sense to anyone except for me. So it's a little piecemeal the way I do it. One of the things I do when I'm first starting to write, though, is that I will draw my characters out. So that's very much a part of my process of figuring out who they are. Okay. So I have an art sketchbook where I have to physically draw my characters and draw out the world and like a map, just so I can orient myself and really understand my characters before I actually start writing about them. So that's like a bit of prep work, organizing work that I do.
And it, was that true of the Legend? Did you approach this series in sort of the same structural way that you approach Legend, or did you change your, I mean, I know the books are totally different, but did you kind of change your formula for how you, how you structured them?
My process of just like chaos everywhere has kind of stayed the same. The one thing that I did start doing with the Young Elise was I started carrying around a handwritten notebook, because for some reason with the Young Elise, it helped me to write down some things by hand, which I never did with Legend. I don't know if that had something to do with the fantasy setting or just the fact that like fantasy seems to require more organization. Just because of keeping like the magic system straight and the country straight and the histories of each land strait. So I had to do a little bit more planning with the Young Elites, but both series are definitely pantsed, and I've tried being an outliner more with both series, doing more outlining. But I've noticed that both times, you know, I'll get like into chapter four of my outline and my story's already off the rails, you know, in the forest. So I'm starting to accept that maybe that's just the way that I work. And there's just like no way around the pantsing. So I might as well just accept it.
The other thing that strikes me as difficult is that you're then constrained by whatever, you know, book one is published and you're bound to that now in book two. And so, it, you know, it doesn't give you a lot of wiggle room sometimes.
Yeah, that can make it hard. That's happened to me a couple of times with Legend and now with the Young Elites, where I'm like, oh, I probably could have put in a line about this earlier in the series. And then I have to try to find a way to go around that.
Yeah. Do you have advice for writing yourself out of messes, sort of, particularly you talked about Adeline, you know, kind of going off in her own directions and getting you stuck. What do you do when you're, you know, when you're kind of stuck in the mud to get yourself backtracked?
It can be pretty tricky. Usually when I hit writer's block, I know that my subconscious is just telling me that there's something that's not working in the story. There's like some kind of plot kink or plot hole that is making me feel uninspired to write that day. So what I usually do is I will read over my notes as much as possible, and then I will step away from the computer for several days, just however long it takes. Sometimes the writer's block will end in a day. Sometimes it'll take weeks for me to get past some hurdle in my writing. But it helps me to just force myself to stay away from the manuscript and not look at it until, you know, I feel something that works. And, you know, give and take, depending on what my deadlines are, sometimes I have to force it a little bit. But what I usually do is try to do something else that's creative but not writing. So I will start drawing. And I tend to upload my sketches online. So whenever my readers see me uploading sketches, they're like, oh, she has writer's block. That's usually like a sign that I have writer's block. So I will draw. I will read. I'll go off and play games or take walks or something, anything to just kind of replenish the creative well and let my subconscious work on the problem. Because usually I will know what's wrong with it. I just can't. It's not coming to the front of my head. So I kind of let myself be away from it for a while. And then usually I'll have a morning or a night where I'm like, oh, that might work. And then I'll go back and restructure things and, you know, rip whole chapters out and stuff. So it kind of comes in little fits and starts.
Yeah. One thing that struck me is young people with physical deformities is such a great concept for this age when, you know, your looks feel so critical and conformity feels so coveted and, you know, the concept that your powers are also your weaknesses and vice versa, I think is really powerful to this age group. And I was wondering, you know, in your teen years, what you needed as a teen and if you kind of got this or if you're writing to your teenage self to say, you know, I would have really benefited from a character like this, or I could have really used Adelina when I was a teenager. We could all use a little Adelina.
Yeah, there's a little Adelina in all of us.
Yeah, right.
I don't want to get too out of control. I was quite insecure as a teenager. And I think it didn't help that when I was 14 or so, my mom cut my hair to be really, really short, and it just was totally traumatizing. And I had this, like, 8-year period where I refused to cut my hair ever, so it became this, like, long rat's nest in the head because I was so traumatized by it. But, like, I think that age of, you know, needing to belong was a huge, huge thing. And I think that's kind of universal for a lot of teenagers, wanting to find your tribe and, you know, knowing where to sit in the cafeteria, you know, who to, like, talk to, like, what group to hang out with. You know, nobody wants to, like, we always are told, like, be yourself, but nobody actually wants to be themselves. They want to belong to a group, you know? And that was absolutely something that I saw when I was that age. So I think I would have related a lot to Adelina had I read about her at that age. And I can still, you know, think back pretty easily to what that was like. And I'm still not totally secure. You know, I still worry about my skin and my hair and my, you know, what is that random mole on my head? And just, you know, just so it's something that I still think about, just the insecurity and the need to belong. And hopefully it's something that young readers can relate to, and see a little bit of themselves and know that, you know, it's okay. Like you said, everything can, all of your weaknesses can also be your strengths, and they manifest in different ways.
Well, you have a vast fan base that I can promise you would tell you you're absolutely perfect as you are, so I wouldn't, don't be too insecure. Are movie rights in the making for these?
Yeah, The Young Elites sold to Temple Hill, which is the house behind The Fault in Our Stars and The Maze Runner. They're really great guys, and so I'm really excited that they're working on it. And 20th Century Fox, so that's the studio behind it. And the last I heard, I actually got on the phone with the producers a few weeks ago, and we went through the first draft of the finished screenplay for The Young Elites. And it's really, really exciting to see their translation of everything. So we're working through revisions on that now. And it's pretty exciting. I mean, I'll keep my fingers crossed that it goes through.
Absolutely.
But,
fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Any last-minute words of writing advice for YA writers out there?
Yeah, writing advice. The biggest piece of advice I had when I was a kid starting to write was that it's more important to finish something than it is to get it right on the first try. Pretty much everyone I know writes first drafts that are not, you know, they're pretty crappy first drafts. Like, no one knocks it out of the ballpark the first time out. So I think it's more important for aspiring writers to know that you have to be able to finish something in order to have something to work with. And that was a hard lesson for me to learn when I first started, because all I wanted to do was to go back and rewrite like 3 chapters over and over and over until I got tired of the story. And I had to learn to turn off that inner editor sometimes and just let myself finish drafts. So that's a big piece of advice that I would give aspiring writers. And I hope that, they go through and finish their stories.
Fantastic. Marie Lu, this was such a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
Wonderful. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show and our journey through young adult fiction. Ellen Hopkins is the number one New York Times bestselling author of Crank, Burned, Impulse, Glass, Identical, Tricks, Fallout, Perfect, Smoke, Tilt, and Rumble, as well as the adult novels Triangles, Collateral, and Love Lies Beneath. But it is her latest young adult novel, Traffic, that we're chatting about today. She lives with her family in Carson City, Nevada, where she has founded Ventana Sierra, a nonprofit youth housing and resources initiative. She's online at ellenhopkins.com. She's on Facebook. She's on Twitter. Ellen, welcome.
Hi, thanks. I'm like, wow, I'm all those places.
I know. I was looking at your website and the long list of books. I'm like, my God, this woman is busy.
It feels that way sometimes. Yes, it does.
I'll bet you do. So we were introduced to these characters originally in Tricks. So maybe by way of introducing us to this novel, you could sort of introduce both books, who these kids are, what inspired them, and sort of what readers can expect.
Sure. So Tricks, so both books explore domestic minor sex trafficking, so teen prostitution, basically. And what got me interested in the idea, my background is nonfiction and journalism, and so sometimes facts or statistics or something will just pique an interest in something that becomes a novel later. Mm-hmm. And I came across the statistic that the average age of a young person trafficked in for sexual exploitation is 12 years old. Mm-hmm. So when something like that kind of strikes me, then I need to know the why of it. So I need to do the research on it, and then in learning about how prevalent the problem is, it became a topic for a book. Mm-hmm. So the original five characters are five young people from all different parts of the country, very different life circumstances, that all end up on the streets of Las Vegas turning tricks. Traffic is their way out. So tricks is their way into the business. Traffic is their way out. Is there a way out? Can you survive? Is survivorship possible? Can you move on with your life afterwards?
Right. Did you always know there was going to be a sequel when you started Tricks, that it was going to be a two-book journey?
Nope. I've never, ever written a book expecting to write a sequel. And I mean, like, never. So, and that includes, like Crank, which was my first, ended up being three books and ended up being a trilogy. It's just sometimes the story demands more storytelling, or readers demand more.
Yeah.
Can I have, I need to know what happens next. You know, I need to know what happens after. So reader demand is a lot of what makes me decide to write a sequel at some point.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, the staggering statistics, you have some of the statistics on sex trafficking amongst teenagers and young people at the back of the book, which are staggering. I was wondering if you could sort of share some of what you learned in your research about this, who the kids are who are at high risk, the most common ways that they get into this, and you know, what their hope level is for getting out of it.
Right, and there are you know, lots of different ways, but there are some basic ways. There's some gang activity involved with that, and sometimes they are traded for debts, gang debt, and sometimes it's even without the gang involvement that young people can be traded by their parents or just, which, you know, it gives you the creeps, but it's true. A lot of times parents will pimp their own kids out. But that's not even as common as just kids who are lacking a lot of support or attention at home. They're kind of ripe for, like, pimps today are very good looking men, and they get these young women to fall in love with them. And often they will get them hooked on a drug, heroin or meth, but usually heroin. And then they become basically their slaves. They have, you know, they're hooked, and they need a way to pay for their habit. But with that love part of that, where they really believe they're in love with these men, it becomes really hard to get them out, because they are pulled toward staying with these men, you know. It's kind of an interesting psychology there. And then there are kids who just know no other lifestyle. You know, they're just, it's something they've seen from either their parents or their friends. That's just, they think that's the only thing they have available for them as a way to make money. So there are lots of different ways in.
Yeah.
Ways out, it takes a lot of support to get out and stay out. Yeah. So either a family has to care enough to want to support their child getting them out, or there are rescue services that do help these young people off the street. Very, very important services, very important parts of our society that recognize the problem and are willing to help and deal with that. Because without that support, you know, a way into school, a way to live without meeting, you know, an income, it's very difficult to get out.
Right. Right. Yeah, the nice thing about having these five characters and being able to follow their stories is their stories are so very different from each other's, and some of them don't see themselves as victims. You know, they see themselves as sort of volunteers in the, you know, in this lifestyle, or participants in this lifestyle. And so it was really, you know, kind of wonderful to get into each individual's psychology and, you know, try and understand what got them there and what kept them there. So let's dive into the characters a little bit. First of all, I should say, for people who haven't picked up your books, they're sort of novels in poetry, or poetry in novels. And maybe we could first talk a little bit about writing in that form. It gave a level of beauty to an otherwise such, you know, such a topic where it's hard to hold yourself still enough to read it, especially as a parent of a teenager. It's hard to take it for too long. And so the poetry lent it, you know, such a level of grace and beauty, and, you know, sort of the language and the way that you assemble the the poems with a separate poem down the side. So maybe you can talk about that form and what led you to that form and what it does for you, and maybe what it doesn't do for you, why it might make it difficult.
It's so my first novel, Crank, which is loosely, it was inspired by my personal story, my daughter's story of meth addiction. And so for me, that's the book that led me into writing YA to start with, because I really felt the need to write for a generation after watching my own child kind of take this horrible path. And I wanted to write first person from her point of view because I wanted to try to understand her. And I started the book in prose, and it was my voice. It was angry. It was bitter. It was not right. So, and I've been writing poetry for a long, long time. And so I decided to try it in verse, and it worked really well. With the earlier stuff, I rely a lot more on kind of concrete poetry, inner shape poetry. With Crank, there were like pages when her thoughts would scatter. I could scatter words across the page. So it worked really well just on a visual level. Mm-hmm. And then as I move forward, the poetry becomes a little bit denser. It's a little bit. It relies less on form and more on poetic device, and as it should. So for me, there's the challenge of making every word count, which I really like. And what I think it does a few things. The white space allows breathing room, so I write tough topics anyway.
Yeah.
It allows places to pause, to think about what you've just read before you have to move on. And there is a visual interest, so for people who assume, especially young people who assume they don't like to read, it kind of stimulates a sort of different part of the brain than just like big blocks of descriptive text or whatever.
Yeah.
And then there is the beauty, there is the poetic devices, the imagery, the sound words, but a lot of that is kind of subconscious, you hear it subconsciously. So it does allow that kind of feeling that you're reading something a little bit more beautiful than necessarily the subject matter.
Right.
And I think it also allows readers onto the page. So instead of feeling like you're being told a story, it feels more like you're there experiencing the story, because you have to fill in the blanks for yourself as far as some of the descriptors and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's a powerful form, it really is.
Yeah, and it really takes you, I think in some of your writing advice, which I want to get to on your website, you were talking about how poetry lends itself to imagery more than, narrative, telling the reader, the classic tell versus show. Poetry really forces you into sort of the right images or the right details, and as you say, it makes every word count. It's really interesting.
And it's more difficult. So, like my latest adult novel, Love Lies Beneath, is the first one that I've done in prose, and it was much faster to write. I mean, it was just I was like going, how did I put so many words down that quickly? Because it's very word placement. Everything in verse is so specific, and I also do one draft. So that means every page is right before I move on to the next one.
Wow.
So on the far end, it's easier, but on the near end, the actual writing process, it feels slow to me, even though I'm writing two books a year, but it feels slow.
Wow. Is that true? You only have one draft, both when you're writing adult fiction and in prose as well as this, or is that a poetry thing? Okay. Wow.
No.
That's awesome.
It took some practice. I wasn't doing that with the first book or two. But, yeah.
So I imagine that's a lot of, it's a lot of line editing as you're going along and making sure every single word is just the right word as you're doing it. That's fantastic.
It is. And like I said, it's time consuming, and it's precise, and it's, so I don't know. I think it would frustrate a lot of writers probably to write like that.
I assume do you read it out loud quite a bit to yourself?
I do. And you kind of need to. And I really like when I can do readings and stuff, because then my readers can hear how it sounds to me.
Yes.
Instead of just kind of rushing through, because younger readers tend to rush through, and then the ones that really love the form will go back and then they'll read for the other stuff, the pretty stuff.
Right. Right. Well, actually, that's a great introduction to let you read to us. Do you mind reading to us from Traffic for just a moment?
Sure. I'd love to. So I'm going to read from Seth, and I think I don't even think I need to introduce him. This is the first couple poems from his section, and I think they introduce him pretty well. So, my soul has taken a vacation, hitched a ride somewhere cool and clean, maybe the mountains. I haven't seen it in months. Perhaps it's deserted me permanently. I should feel bad, but I can't muster sympathy for the boy become man who is me. Man, gay man, kept man. You'll find the ultimate meaning of that term in the eyes of every boy forced by circumstance to sacrifice the truth of himself. I keep digging for truth, but can't seem to find it in me. I swore I'd never get used to living like this. At the beck and call and under almost total control of another human being. I say almost because after Carl, my ex-sugar daddy, when I moved in here with David, I knew enough to find a way to stash some cash in case I ever need an escape plan. Carl, who brought me with him from Louisville, a trophy houseboy to decorate his Lake Las Vegas luxury condo, allowed me no chance at personal resources. He wanted ownership. Slavery is alive and thriving in Sin City, Nevada. Maybe that's why I gambled on connecting with hot stranger in the gym, Jared, the growing need for rebellion, or at least a taste of autonomy. Or maybe it was simply because I'm only 18 and still stashed inside is the belief that love waits for me somewhere.
Oh, that's so great. That was Ellen Hopkins reading from Traffic, her latest novel. It's a sequel to her novel, Tricks. So maybe we can talk a little bit about these characters and mining the characters, how you got to know them, which characters may have given you the most trouble, and kind of take us into these five people a little bit.
Yeah, well, I will say that all five are inspired by real stories. And in Traffic, you get some of the peripheral story, like other characters have also been in the trade. And all these stories are inspired by real stories, real people. So we have Seth, who you just heard, who was an Indiana farm boy, and his father kicked him out, and he had no way to survive other than to find an older man to take care of him. We have Whitney, who's a wealthy young woman who's not getting enough attention at home, and the pimp sucks her up and gets her hooked on heroin. Ginger, whose mother actually pimped her out, she thought she was raped, but she found out that her mother sold her. So she runs away and ends up in Las Vegas stripping to survive. Mm-hmm. We have Eden, who's from a religious background, whose mother locked her away in a kind of rehab camp because she didn't like the boy she was dating. And Eden escapes that. Mm-hmm. And then we have Cody, who's just a regular kid who develops a gambling habit and sucks up his mother's bank account without meaning to and then needs a way to put money back and can't figure out another way to do it. So those are the five. And again, they're all very different parts of it. They all come from different places. They all have different circumstances because all kinds of different kids end up, you know, here on the streets of Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. And not just Las Vegas. I mean, I chose Las Vegas because we actually had a big bust of 120 young people in Reno, which is where I live. I live close to Reno. But they were moving them. They were going to move them to Vegas. And Vegas, it is a big piece of the sex trafficking trade in southern Nevada, the domestic minor sex trafficking. Right. So they sell them on Craigslist. There are different ways that they do it. And Vegas was available to me so I could spend some time down there researching, talking to kids on the street, working with Las Vegas Vice, sitting in on there's a court that's specifically for minor, teen prostitutes, sitting in on some of their stuff, and so it was available. But it's not just in Las Vegas, and it's not just in Nevada, it's in almost any major metropolitan area in this country that you will find this, and in some smaller towns, too. It's pretty much everywhere. There's a market for it, which is a problem.
Right. Was the research fairly, did the kids talk to you pretty readily, or how did the research process go for you?
Actually, they did. And because I'm not a threat to them, on the talking to the kids on the street, there was, you know, some suspicion if I went with the cops, but a lot of times it would be, you know, they kind of almost anxious to share their stories, you know, their reasons why they're there. Because I think there's a confessional need in humans anyway, but especially in young people. And then also I have a pretty wide social media network, and so I had a lot of kids that just came to me when they knew I was writing the sequel specifically to share their stories with me.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I'm talking with Ellen Hopkins. The book now is Traffic. It's the sequel to Tricks. We are talking young adult fiction, and you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Were there characters in here who, we talk a lot about voice on this show, your voice versus character voice. Were there voices that were more difficult in coming, and sort of how did you get into some of the more difficult characters?
Well, I'm not a gay farm boy, but he wasn't that hard for me to write. My oldest son is gay, so I've got some feeling of, you know, some of the kind of the psychology of that, of feeling like, you know, not accepted because of that. Probably the hardest one to get into is probably Eden, only because the person that inspired her was someone I spoke extensively to, and so I wanted her enough different from that person, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, right.
So I was trying not to sound too much like her, and then so that was harder. Cody, just a regular kid, you know, he was pretty. I mean, I think character for me, it's what I do. You know, it's so character is not a real issue for me. Ginger, kind of that smarmy, you know, smart voice. I've got an 18-year-old kid, so I'm sort of like her. So there are a lot of examples around me, and I just, it's because I'm actively involved with young people daily, you know, and so that to me, I hear their voices and different voices a lot,
yeah.
And, you know, either online or just because of the kids in my house or the kids I've already raised or whatever. So I think teen characters, they pretty much yap through me. I feel more like I channel characters, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it strikes me now that I hear that you write it straight through, that you would have to then switch characters. I mean, you know, you know, the story is told one at a time, and so to get your voice to switch every, you know, 10 pages or so, would be its own challenge, and to get yourself in a totally different mindset to write each different character would be its own challenge. I was going to ask if you stayed with a character kind of through their whole arc, but it sounds like you don't.
No, I don't. Amber Shears does that with her Traveling Pants characters, and we've actually discussed it. So it's just, for me, the process is so different. If I don't write chronologically, I'm going to get lost.
Yeah.
So even if I was writing in prose, I'd be writing this way, you know. And I don't write. Like, I have friends that write scenes that are like way off in a book, and then they'll figure out how to connect scenes. And I would just be like, I would lose it. No, I don't have enough control over what's happening in my story here.
Right.
So for me, I need to follow, just write chronologically. And I actually like switching character voices because it keeps me interested in the story, and it keeps me also involved with that character, you know, pretty regularly.
Yeah.
Rather than leaving four behind, you know, to write a whole arc or whatever. So
right.
It makes more sense to me to write that way.
Right. One thing that I think is worth mentioning, because I hear this a lot from a question from listeners about young adult writing, is people think that if you're writing for young adults, the language has to be tamped down or the subject matter has to be tamped down. And this is the best example I can think of to tell writers interested in young adult fiction that the only real restriction on young adult fiction is that the protagonists need to be young adults. But, you know, you shouldn't dumb down the subject matter or, you know, assume that you're talking down to young adults reading it, that all of that should be at the same adult level, I think. Would that be your answer?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, first of all, kids are pretty sophisticated today, for the most part, and you know, just the stuff that they're dealing with, not to mention stuff they're seeing on television or internet or whatever, you know, it's it's way beyond anything I would have seen in high school.
Yeah.
But I was reading adult in high school because we didn't have young adult, you know, when I was there. So I think respect for the generation is vital. You have to believe and understand that the stuff, you know, that their lives are not easy. Even, you know, cheerleaders have problems, and, you know, football players have problems, and class presidents, they all have problems. So their lives are not as easy as we would assume or even maybe hope that they are, because
right.
They're not. They're pretty complicated. And writing down to them, I mean, no way. That's why I'm as honest as I am with the books I write, you know, and I take a lot of flack, and I'm regularly challenged and banned and whatever. But if you don't write with the respect for that generation that they deserve, there's no use writing for them.
I
feel like, you know, I want to feel like that they can trust me, that what is going in my books is honest, and they do.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so I don't know why it hadn't really occurred to me that you would probably be challenged a lot in school libraries or whatnot for the subject matter. Is that an ongoing concern of yours, or is that something that comes up frequently, the banned book question?
Oh, yeah, it is. I mean, you know, I'm always on the list. My books are on the list. And it's you know, it's like, I think those challenges come, for the most part, out of a place of really, you know, concern. But I don't think there's a real understanding from those people of again, what's happening. You know, every kid deserves to see themselves in a book somewhere.
Yeah.
Or if they have a friend they don't understand, or even the kid over there that they can't stand, that they want some kind of insight into why that kid is that big a jerk. You know what I mean?
I love that.
So
yeah.
I think as far as the challenging and banning go, what I do is I keep a file of reader letters that tell me, you know, they come and they're like, your books, you know, and it sounds melodramatic, but for them it's the truth. Your book saved my life because I was considering suicide, but I read Impulse, so I decided I didn't want to do that to my family. I was considering using meth, and I decided I wasn't, you know what I mean? It's like, so I keep a list, I mean, a file of those letters, and when there's a challenge, if I know about it, then I can send that file to, like, the librarian or whoever's facing the challenge, and almost always the challenge will go away.
That's amazing.
It's when I don't hear and they don't, that the other side isn't presented, that's when the books come off the bookshelves.
Right.
And I think it's a real shame to take books off the bookshelves in high school libraries and even middle school libraries, you know, because there are kids 11, 12 years old who have already been introduced to drugs, who have already been pimped, and I've heard, my mom pimped me out when I was 10 years old, you know, so every kid's life is different, and so they should have books that represent their lives or can help them make better choices, no matter where they are on that spectrum.
I love it. I love it. I want to give it a shout out to your website, which is filled with some really great advice for writers, ellenhopkins.com. And one of the pieces of advice I thought was really clever that I hadn't heard before is not only to take classes in writing or writing workshops, but to take classes in psychology and sociology and some of these other, you know, adult extension classes at night that you could do right here at UCI. The UCI has a great adult extension courses at night, you know, where you can get more insight into, isn't all of writing human psychology, and the more access you get to how people work, the better. I thought that was really great advice.
Right. I think I just got a delivery.
You have to go.
It's that time of year. Santa's at the door. No, I think, you know, for me, I think character is everything. I mean, without character, who wants to read a book if you don't care about the characters?
Yeah.
So, you know, knowing how people tick and what makes humans work and, you know, even things like religion, which especially, you know, now is it's such a driving question in so many people's minds right now, you know, religion, whatever, to understand, you know, what those religions are, you know, how they might make you behave if you were a Muslim, you know, versus a Baptist or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think,
right.
And that stuff anyway is just, you should be interested in people and all kinds of people, because you can't be a writer without that, I don't think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should also mention there are notes on here on agents and on poetry and on publishing and on craft. It's really a wealth of information. But I'll ask you to leave us with just your favorite piece of writing advice at all for people who are either young adult fiction or regular adult fiction. I know you do a lot of work in nonfiction, but what writing advice has served you sort of the best over the years?
Well, first of all, don't write for money, don't write for awards, don't write for reviews. Write the stories that mean the most to you, that speak very loudly to your heart. Because those are the ones that are going to resonate with readers. If you care about the characters, if you care about the story, if it's vital for you to write, that's going to be the story that resonates with readers and probably a publisher and editor if that's the place where you are an agent. So, and write bravely. Don't self-censor.
Yeah.
Write the story that needs to be told.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's perfect advice coming from you. That's what I appreciated the most about this: the honesty and the willingness to, you know, just as I always call it, holding your hand to the flame. The willingness to walk straight into the darkness and not flinch, I think, does everybody a service. And your comments on everybody deserves to see a reflection of themselves in literature, I think that's really great. Ellen Hopkins, thanks so much for taking the time. This was a real treat.
Oh, thank you. This is great.
Happy New Year.
Appreciate being here. All right.